G-Force, a kaiju podcast.
G-Force?
Well, it's big and terrible. More frightening than I ever thought possible.
Kiss you, guys.
What terrible language!
Now, your hosts.
One is me, and the other is Godzilla.
Nick and Andrew.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of G-Force, a kaiju podcast, a show in which a rotating cast of kaiju enthusiasts get together every other week to discuss all things kaiju. My name is Nick, and with me is my co-host,
Andrew.
And with us tonight we have...
Hello, I'm Brendan.
Hey, this is Evan.
And this is Parker.
Before we get into this episode, we just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge the sad news. Just a day after the release of our last episode, Shunsuke Kikuchi, composer of Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z, and the last four Showa Gamera films, died. I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge this really underappreciated composer. I know after we did our episode on Gamera Super Monster and did purchase the soundtrack for that for use in the episode, I fell in love with the score for that film. It is this wonderful sort of disco bop. It is just a fantastic score, a wonderful alternate theme for Gamera, in much the way that the Millennium series provided several new Godzilla themes. And it is just fantastic. I feel as if he was a very talented composer, but probably not so much of a household name, at least here in the West. Not in the way an Akira Ifukube is, certainly. But he deserves recognition for some fantastic work, and we are very saddened to hear of his passing. Now, on with the show.
So today, we will be discussing 1966's Daimajin, directed by Kimiyoshi Yasuda and written by Tetsuro Yoshida.
As it turns out, this episode is quite timely, as Arrow has just announced, as of April 30th, a Daimajin Blu-ray set for the entire trilogy, much as they did with Gamera before them. So if you want to check out Daimajin, that may be a great new way to do so. And this first film is also available in pretty good quality on YouTube. Though who knows if that may be disappearing soon with a rights crackdown because of the new release.
So, Andrew, would you like to give us our synopsis?
Absolutely. A group of villagers make a hasty prayer march in the night to appease the Majin monster, a spirit of the mountains who's been trapped. But they also trust in the god of the mountains who will protect their village from monsters and all evil. What they don't count on is a coup. Upstart Samanosuke betrays the samurai lord Hanabusa, slaying him. But loyal servant Kojenta ushers the young prince Tadafumi and Princess Kosaza to safety amidst the violence. Kojenta's aunt Shinobu, the priestess of the rituals, now banned under the new lord, leads them into the mountains and hides them in the grottos of the mountain god. 10 years later, the year in which Kojenta's kinsmen had pledged that they would meet up to retake the castle should they survive that fateful night, Samanosuke is a ruthless slave driver, working the villagers in brutal labor to build gates for the village, with designs for seizing the capital as he once seized the village. Aided by enforcer Gunjiro, his right-hand man, he's a tyrant through and through. The prince, Tadafumi, now a young man, wants to act right away. Kojenta precedes him to seek out allies, but is quickly captured and tortured for the prince and princess's location. Tadafumi ventures into the village to rescue him and is also captured, facing execution in the morning. The priestess Shinobu goes to confront Samanosuke, who merely decides to vandalize the warrior god statue in the mountains in response to her warnings. When he kills her for those warnings, she calls down the wrath of the mountain god with her dying breath. A young child whose father was arrested for helping Kojenta and fled to the mountains, along with the Princess Kosaza, are captured by the party sent to destroy the statue, led by Gunjiro, and taken to the statue. However, when they try to destroy it with a chisel, it begins to bleed. A storm arises, and the ground splits, devouring Gojiro and his men. And with the dawn swiftly approaching, Kosaza prays to the mountain god for her brother and Kojenta's rescue, offering herself in their place. At last, Daimajin awakes. Rising, the statue assumes a visage of flesh, and as a storm and ball lightning precedes it, it storms the village, freeing the captives and annihilating Samanosuke's men. Finally, Samanosuke is picked up like an oversized Andero, carried out of the village, and impaled to a beam by the chisel that Daimajin pulls out of his own head. Daimajin is entirely ready to kill all of the villagers as well, but when Kosaza throws herself over the boy, who Daimajin is about to step on, the mountain god halts rather than trample her. Transforming back into his statue form, he crumbles into dust, the spirit animating it, returning to the mountain.
So what do you guys think of this movie?
I honestly loved it. This is my first time watching it for the podcast. I gotta say, this is a really good movie. Like, I heard it was good, but this is one of the best kaiju movies I've seen in a while.
You know, it was my first time as well, and I was not over the moon about it, but I liked it. It was not what I was expecting. It was kind of what I was expecting, but it was a much slower burn, and yeah, overall, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's definitely something I noticed. More of a slow burn. It honestly feels more like a typical samurai film just until the end when it goes full in on all the kaiju craziness.
So, I mean, I guess I'm the only one who's seen this before. It's something that when I first saw it, I saw it for the first time probably about 10 years ago, and I was really surprised by it. Repeat viewing left me sort of the same kind of impression where I'm surprised more people don't talk about it because I feel like it's very well made. It is definitely a slower burn. And I think, unfortunately, it is a kaiju film, but it's not really a kaiju film. Like it's not something that you're not going to watch an hour and a half of, you know, a monster destroying a city. But it's a very satisfying film to watch, I think. It's a very melancholy film. It's a very dreary visual film until the end. It appeals right to my senses. I love the atmosphere. I love the aesthetic. I really enjoy it.
Oh, I really dig this movie. I was super excited when it came up in the random number generator. Okay, so these movies were largely the brainchild of producer Masaichi Nagata and special effects director Yoshiyuki Kuroda. Nagata was also producer on the Gamera movies, and the same pair, along with this movie's director, Kimiyoshi Yasuda, were the creative team behind Daiei's Yokai trilogy as well. Those are really cool movies, and if you guys haven't checked them out, I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, this was also my first time watching it, and at first my train of thought was, this is pretty good. I don't love it, but it's pretty good. But then as soon as Daimajin shows up, it suddenly is just on a completely different level. So, and I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't expecting Daimajin to only be in like the final, to only be in like the climax of the movie. I thought he'd be in it a little more, but that's okay. I'm not complaining about it. Just, I wasn't expecting it. So, there were a couple points where I was like, when's he going to show up? But, yeah, when he does show up, it's extremely satisfying. It's awesome. The effects are incredible. I was blown away by that part, and it made me like the movie a lot more than I did before he showed up. So that brings us to our human characters. For our cast, we have Miwa Takada as Hanabusa Kozasa, Masako Morishita as young Kozasa, Yoshihiko Aoyama as Hanabusa Tadafumi, Hideki Ninomiya as young Tadafumi, Jun Fujimaki as Sarumaru Kojenta, Otome Tsukimiya as Shinobu, Ryutaro Gomi as Odate Samanosuke, Tatsuo Endo as Inugami Gunjiro, and Shizuhiro Izoguchi as Takebo, aka the boy.
My wife felt this movie was really stressful. Like, she was commenting on it a lot, like how much this was just stressing her out. I think she was invested a bit deeper than I was, and she was really attached to Kojenta. Like, when, you know, he was being hung upside down and Tadafumi was trying to rescue him, and she's like, if anything happens to Kojenta, you know. I wasn't there. I felt like, to me, the priestess Shinobu was like the most defined character of the film, and even then, she's just sort of like, her noteworthy trait is boldness, and Kojenta is like a valiant warrior, but there's not much more to be said about his character to that. Like, to me, a lot of the characters are primarily archetypes, sort of with the exception of maybe the priestess, the boy, and the princess at the end, who sort of pulls a bit of a Ripley and like is just in the background at the beginning, but by the end she's the central character.
For me, a lot of the characters seem to sort of blend together, with the exception of the priestess. Like, I felt like, especially that scene with her and the, I don't know the guy's name, but the warlord, was probably my favorite human scene in the movie. And watching him cut her down and just having those, I would assume, generals kind of just sitting there watching her with like this sinister grin on their all their faces as they watch her die. And he's sort of, she's like just not literally cursing her, but cursing him, but kind of cursing him, saying that, you know, God will come after you. And he just like pulls the sword out again and slashes her. Like, that to me was, that was my favorite human part of the film. She's probably the most interesting human character. The rest all sort of were just, I don't want to say they're generic, but kind of generic.
They're like, you have sympathetic character, like the boy and his father and Kojenta and the prince and princess in the beginning. But they're just kind of there to like fill the little moments and roles in a plot-driven film. Like, they aren't cardboard cutouts or anything, but they're just dropped into the standard film situations and tableaus. They're like, they're placed into the usual cookie cutter moments meant to engender sympathy, appreciation, fear, contempt. The villains are despicable and the heroes are laudable, mostly because of the situations they're put in, the standard movie hero villain actions they take, and little moments of dialogue or expression, rather than being especially three-dimensional on their own. Except for, as you mentioned, scenes like that one, which, I mean, I knew that she was going to be killed from her first scene. She was standing up to evil authorities way too much, but I was really hoping that she wouldn't be.
Yeah, she was definitely the most interesting character to me. She was definitely my favorite. And yeah, that scene where her death scene is great. Like, and especially how like everything kind of goes like black behind her, and then she kind of has that lighting like on her face, sort of, I guess. It's a really, really great looking scene. And she's a total badass. Like, from the moment she stands up to that guy on the horse and she's just like, no, like, I'm doing this ritual thing or whatever. Like, get out of my face. I thought she was great. And I was sad when she died, but her death scene was awesome enough to make it worth it.
Yeah, it's actually kind of interesting because there's, I also love that scene where as she's dying, everything goes black behind her. It's one of the few moments in the movie where the atmosphere really shifts. And then the other thing will be when we discuss later when Daimajin actually arrives and that all shifts. But one thing that's really cool with her too early is when they're taking the kids out of the town. There's like this really melancholy music playing and she's taking them to the statue and she's sort of like, I don't know how to describe it, but she's kind of, she almost seems like remorseful and regretful, but she's still just sort of like, no, this, we have to take you to the statue. This is where you'll be safe. God will protect you. And then I love how it's all so melancholy. It's also like dreary and hopeless. And then it kind of just cuts to, hey, look, we caught rabbits. Everything's great and wonderful. But yeah, I every scene she was in, I found very enjoyable, even though she as a character outside of the film probably isn't that memorable, but within the context, like in this film, she's very cool.
And you know, you guys talked about the whole, her actual death scene and everything going black. But before that, to me, the fake out with Simonosuke is going to shoot her. And he's like, hey, if you really trust your God, you shouldn't be worried about anything, you know? And you get that slow zoom in as he pulls the trigger. Like, that to me was just dripping with tension and was like, so no, don't do it. And then he does. And then she's safe. And you're like, oh, maybe he was just messing with her. Maybe he just knew that it wasn't loaded, you know? And then the fact that she just keeps pushing. And the moment he threatened the statue, I know, oh, this is a point of no return. This is not going to work out here. And in standard movie fashion, like, supernatural forces really only decide to get off their lazy behinds when a dying person calls them in for a curse. But, like, just that whole thing was just so intense. And the relief, oh, they're not going to kill her. And then go, oh, no, they really are. And it's just, like, such a bummer, honestly, to find someone who isn't afraid of her. Because you get the sense that a lot of the other villainous characters would. They don't respect her. They don't care about killing innocent people. But they're a little afraid of, what if she really can do what she says? And in Simonosuke, she finds sort of the consummate skeptic, that this is all superstition and nonsense. He is not afraid of her. And that's what destroys him, which is very sad for her, but, you know, thematically appropriate for his own comeuppance. It's his own disbelief in the forces that he is meddling with that engineers his own destruction.
Yeah, I agree. That scene was just, that scene right there might be my favorite scene in the movie. It was just like what you were saying, Andrew, about how tense the gun fake out was, her like pushing through it and like becoming like this spirit of warning, like, where you're going, you're not coming back from this, bud. It was just, oh, I loved it so much. It was amazing. I can't even think of the right words. I'm literally speechless thinking about it. I'd also like to add, while I'm talking about characters, I actually kind of like Simonosuke. Not liked, but like, he's kind of like Carl Nelson in Mothra. He's just like a villain who's like so scummy that you can't help but like kind of like enjoy watching him, because you're like, oh, I cannot wait for you to get your just desserts, bud.
I do like that you get sort of this just subtle hints in the background of his empire building. Like, you're told of the ambitions on the capital, and you see him building these gates, slave driving them to build these gates that he wants to protect his city, you know, to fortify it as his fortress. But you also see him in that scene with the priestess, that he is testing out a rifle. And you get the feeling, since it's the first time we've really seen these, that maybe that's a new innovation he's getting in. And once again, it's just kind of a subtle bit that's there in plain sight, uncommented on, that he is gearing up for a war. And that's nicely supplied in there.
Yeah, I thought the villains in this were super great. Him and Gunjiro both. And they both have great death scenes. This movie has awesome death scenes.
Yeah, honestly, all the mysticism, whether it's with the priestess or the villains and their comeuppance, like, it's all very, I don't want to say it's unique necessarily, but it feels sort of special in this one. It's one of the reasons I love GMK so much, is I love when spirituality and kaiju mix. And I love the way that the priestess is sort of treated by how she's treated differently by both sides. How, you know, the villains treat her one way and the heroes earlier treat her with such a different sort of reverence and respect. And obviously, again, it's pretty obvious. It's an obvious storytelling technique, but it was just really enjoyable to watch. But to sort of segue into other characters, the girl and the kid, while they're not the most prevalent characters, I found towards the end of the film that I was pretty engaged with them and what was going on during the final Daimajin attack.
I felt like the kid ends up becoming an unexpected, like, protagonist toward the middle when he's, you know, going up into the mountains and dealing with all the haunted stuff, which we'll talk about, you know, in the special effects section. But to me, that also kind of highlighted, like, the famous Plinkett critique of The Phantom Menace. There doesn't seem to be a clear protagonist or focused character in this movie. Like, it's Kojenta or the priestess at first, then it shifts to the prince, then it turns into the boy and the princess. Like, this is a movie, again, that seems like it's so much more about plot than any specific character. And so it doesn't really have that audience identification protagonist figure.
Honestly, it kind of reminded me of the original Godzilla in that way, because that movie also kind of tends to, like, switch protagonists as it goes on. Like, at first, it's, forgive me if I'm misremembering here, but at first it's Ogata, and then it's, like, Dr. Yamane, and then Emiko, and then Sarazawa. And this film kind of reminds me of that, with the way it switches focus on certain characters.
I don't know what you're talking about. It's Steve Martin all the way through.
Oh yeah, that's right.
The lack of that clear protagonist-focused character means that they end up having a lot of little vignettes. You have, like, with Take's father, you know, and the drama of his wife dying, which is incredibly depressing and tragic. And then you have the whole sick ward escape, and not only the guy that's letting them go, which might have been Take's father again, I couldn't tell in the dark, but also the guy that, you know, knows he's dying, so takes the you know, intended reprisal on his behalf. You have a lot of little characters. And again, that's why none of them really get developed with any depth, but each is almost like a thread in the tapestry. Their little emotional beats, their moments within the film help to tell the overall story, like Parker was saying, of good and evil. You know, you have Kojenta's nobility, and then you have Tadafumi's brashness. Neither says that much about them as a character, and they are quickly captured and sort of exiled out of the plot. But they do enough to show the side of good and what it's up to. You have these multiple little villagers, and you don't know much about each of them, but they work together to show the story thread of the oppression of these villagers, that there is nobility there, but they are being downtrodden and severely mistreated. So each of them almost works together collectively to make a point in little moments of pathos or little moments of human emotion, rather than developing specific characters and having the emotional through line come through them.
Yeah, I kind of got that feel too, this, like, there's no one clear person. It's kind of like all these different people and how, like, they all react once Daimajin actually awakens and, like, their hopes in Daimajin.
Well, it seems it is sort of like the Plinkett review, and it is sort of, in a way, it is kind of like Gojira, but it's ultimately sort of just the sides of good and bad and righteousness and, you know, the darkness of evil, and which is why, you know, when Daimajin comes out, he's almost sort of this vessel of vengeance in a way. You know, he's, you know, we'll get into that a little bit later, but he's punishing the wicked characters. Like, I don't think it's a mistake that there's a lot of mention of God and there's a lot of cross imagery. Like, I don't think any of that's there unintentionally. I could totally be wrong. I don't really know what religion is like over in Japan in terms of Christianity, but I do know that God and, like, the Christian God seems to come up a lot more than I would expect it to, because I thought they were Buddhists, but I guess.
Yeah, well, we were talking about that in Zone Fighter the other episode, how you had, like, the woman praying and, like, crossing herself. And
yes, yes, yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right.
And a lot of Mothra and, you know.
Yes, and Mothra too. And yep.
Well, this movie, I thought they were talking about their mountain god thing.
Right, but there's, like, yes, but you can't really ignore the fact that at the end, and I mean, again, we're getting into this later, but there's two guys up on crosses.
That's true.
That's some pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a guy is impaled at the end, and if you notice what he's impaled on, which we'll talk about later, but he's impaled on a cross-like shape. the wood that he's impaled on is a cross. So it's, yes, it is the, obviously the god they're referring to ends up being their mountain god, kind of like Varon is their lake god, or, you know, King Kong is an island god, whatever it may be. But there's some serious Christian imagery in that. And I would assume that would fall in with good, evil, right, wrong, you know, the righteous and et cetera. But, that, you know, that's just my musing.
You know, this occurs to me, though, this whole big buildup to the mountain god, it's so important. He's going to come protect us. The princess is the one that has to come wake him up. And then when he does, he's this epic force of, you know, vessel of vengeance or monster of justice, to coin a phrase. This feels like maybe even what inspired, but certainly what they were going for with King Caesar. And it feels like if you put Daimajin in the place of King Caesar, imagine a buildup as successful as this one, a mythos around him and a presence to him like this one, then it feels like all of a sudden I totally get what they were going for in Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. Like, he was supposed to be this, it just didn't work out. But if they had successfully made him this in the way that this film makes him such an imposing and significant, and you're anticipating his awakening presence, then that would have been amazing, and even his brief participation in the battle would still have been a satisfying resolution to that. Like, it just feels to me now, suddenly, like King Caesar was meant to be what Daimajin is here.
Imagining Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, but with Daimajin instead, it's so much cooler. I will say something that did bother me was that once Kogento was captured and then later once Tadafumi is captured, I really didn't like how they were just kind of completely absent from the film until like the end. I don't know. I just feel like I didn't really get enough time to really care about them, and then they were just kind of gone, and it just felt weird to me, and I wasn't super into that aspect of the story.
I like after he was captured, and they have, like, the one dude who just has, like, the hot poker just, like, slash his chest, and then the other guy, and like I told you, I'm not going to bother naming names, I'm just going to say that guy and that guy. And you have the other guy come down and be like, no, don't waste your time. You know, he'll tell us everything soon enough. And then he just proceeds to laugh for like a solid 2 minutes straight off screen. And it's glorious.
I was actually just going to mention the fire poker thing. That scene was, yeah, that was very uncomfortable even now. But, something else I just found in my notes that I wanted to bring up that I really kind of thought was interesting was like how there's kind of this little subtle role reversal in the film between the characters that I like only just caught, which is that like, I'm not going to bother his name either. The prince is like, they're like kind of built up that like, oh, he's been training the swords. He's very angry about what's going down in the village. And you're thinking, okay, he's going to go down. He's going to go fight Sansume and he's going to win and save the day just when Daimajin shows up. But no, he gets immediately captured, and the day is saved because the priestess uses religion and her, like, compassion to wake up Daimajin, and he just saves the day for them. I thought that was kind of interesting, that, like, they kind of had started hinting at, like, what I thought was going to be a traditional samurai narrative, and they just kind of, like, changed it to fit the kaiju narrative, like, halfway through.
That is true, and actually, I think you made me appreciate that a little more. And yeah, I really did like how the princess kind of becomes the main focus and how she kind of ends up saving the day. That is pretty good.
Sorry, Daimajin, our prince is in another castle.
There is one henchman of Samusuke who is most prominent after the priestess dies. And he's like, sir, are you sure you want to go after the statue? That looks exactly like Japanese Ian McKellen, young Ian McKellen, and I just wanted to bring him up because that's like, that was something that came up in my notes like 5 times, so that's it.
So that will bring us to the special effects and the monster.
And oh, I got much to say here.
Yeah. The special effects were done by Yoshiyuki Kuroda, and Daimajin was played by Chikara Hashimoto.
So right off the bat, I thought the opening title is a combination of kind of cool, but also like crazy cheap, because it's just this really crude rotoscoping of like rusty metal letters that look kind of cool. Like, destroy all monsters, this ain't. It definitely has a cheaper feel. Like, we got these cool real metal texture letters, but we hired the high school rotoscoping like intern to actually get them up on screen. And then we just open with this eyeball, and like my wife and I were both going, what the heck? What do we? And then it like zooms into a mountain. And then there's some dark thing that isn't quite motion tracked to the cliff. And we were like, what is happening here? Like, are we going to get a monster for Daimajin to fight right at the beginning? Like, what am I? I'm guessing it's like the trapped spirit of the mountain in retrospect. But right at the beginning of the film, it was much more of like, wow, what is this?
I didn't understand the eyeball at all, but I thought it was really cool.
I think it's just supposed to be something spooky to add to like the spookiness of like the haunted mountain forest and all.
I mean, it also could have been like hinting at Daimajin, since it's like a like an eyeball against a rocky background, and you know, he's a stone monster, but he's got like real eyeballs.
That was another thing that really confused me in this film. The relationship between the statue, the mountain god, and the monster was very unclear. Like, at first, I took the statue to be the god and the Daimajin to be the monster, sealed like Jiger style underneath it. The translation I watched was not really clear enough in the nuances to be able to make the distinction. Toward the end, I was like, oh, wait, is the monster and the mountain god one and the same? But then how would the mountain god protect them from the monster? And it seemed like the mountain god, because it's the thing that protected them from evil, was coming, but it woke up and it was walking toward them, but then the spirit appeared in the sky. So was the actual walking monster like the god possessed by the monster, and that's why he turns into scary? Like, are they two separate entities? Are they one entity? Which entity was it? If it was just... I was not clear on that at all.
Same. It was super unclear.
Okay, so I have two opinions of this. One, it was just the... I took it as the... It was the mountain god that was trapped underneath the statue, and it was trapped underneath the statue kind of like a Jiger situation, but it ended up sort of just... it's a confusing situation. But honestly, I've always sort of kind of digested it more as these people fear this god, and they've attributed this whole, okay, there's a mountain god there, put the statue of this thing that keeps it scared and keeps it trapped, blah, blah, blah. But I've kind of always attributed it to sort of more like Veron, where like it's all sort of situational, and it just happens that there's just this spiritual creature that lives in the mountains, and what happens, happens. It is tricky. It's not entirely clear. I don't know how much of that is lost just in translation, or how much of that is just the movie not giving enough explanation.
I also had the same problem, especially because whenever I tried to look it up to figure it out, there's always a different source. Like, Wikisilia says, oh, it's a spirit in a statue. Other place says the statue isn't possessed by the spirit. I think, on this part, I think it's really hard to tell what's translation, what's intentionally ambiguous. The way I kind of read it was, I thought it was kind of a GMK situation. It's like there's this forest god who trapped an evil spirit in a statue, and they kind of like share the statue to like, so like the evil spirit is still in the statue, but the god can like work, control his like purified him so that like he follows the will of the people or something. Like, because that's what I got. Like, spirit was going to go just destroy the evil no matter what, with like really no morals, until the princess stopped him with like her sacrifice and her tears. But again, it's really not clear. I think that's I gotta be honest, that kind of didn't work for me. Most of the times I like keeping these weird spiritual things ambiguous, but here they kind of left it too ambiguous about what's what, and I don't know if that's just the translation or if that's the film itself.
Well, this first movie does present a particularly ambivalent relationship with Majin, doesn't it? His awakening is very much a blessing and a curse. The dark side of the monster would play a diminishing role in the next two entries to the trilogy.
I was looking up to see what I could find out on, if there's any sort of confirmation on Daimajin from people who are better at this than we are. And I found something that sort of does, kind of. But also found out that evidently Daimajin was actually originally designed to be Gamera's first foe during the development of Gamera versus Barugan.
That would have been awesome, and it also fits the story. That's...
Right.
Coming after the statue and everything. That would have been so cool.
I totally agree with you. Yeah, no, I think ultimately I like Barugan so much as a kaiju, and I like Barugan so much as a film, like Daimajin so much as a kaiju, like Daimajin so much as a film, both on their own, that I'm okay how things went out, but I would be very interested to see how things would have gone.
The inspiration came from the German silent movies about the golem, which is a creature of living clay derived from Jewish folklore. They combined that idea with traditional Japanese mythology, which tended to assign spiritual identities to natural phenomena. Across all the movies, Majin appears to exercise some control over various elements. But the specific character of Daimajin was an original creation. The word Majin doesn't have a direct English translation, but it can basically be read as demon or evil god. And I guess burying statues of Buddha and praying to them before battle was an actual ancient practice. So this movie takes place somewhere in the early Edo era, like in the 17th century, but Majin is supposed to be a legend even to the characters in the movie, so his design, which is based on old clay figures, reflects the much earlier Kofun period, dating the statue to something in the 4th through 6th centuries.
But anyway, what I ended up finding out was that a kind warrior named Shino fought Daimajin some years ago and won. He trapped the spirit of Daimajin inside a stone statue. From that day forward, Daimajin could be summoned by people who needed his help, but only by waking the spirit from its slumber within the statue. So basically, the god is Daimajin, and the statue is sort of just a kind of a, it is sort of a King Caesar sort of situation, more or less.
And it seems like the monster and the god locked in combat is just a mythology that sprung up around it, a legend, but the only with the spark of truth that there is a mountain god up there. Although it's funny, because I feel like the eyeball and the dark shape baying at the top of the cliff does imply that there is a monster there too. That's the weird part. Like, we literally visibly see manifestations of like an evil presence in the mountain, which almost makes you wonder if, like, oh wait, there really was a monster. He just didn't wake up during the course of this movie. He's like there ready as sequel bait. There actually was something. We just didn't get around to him.
That's actually really funny to me, because I actually put in my notes, Force God versus Daimajin, the ultimate sequel, we were cut lost. But I think what was going on with all the dark stuff was, I think they were trying to like imply this force isn't natural, it's like supernatural. Well, that sounded incredibly stupid, but you know what I mean? That's just like a force that's like closer to the other world. So like, yeah, there are monsters and other ghosts there because it's part of the spirit world. And that's why you can contact Daimajin there, because he's easier to hear there.
Well, yeah, that's actually what I was going to say was, I think you're onto something. I think it's the idea that the forest is sort of a dark and mystical place, and these people are on the end of it, and that's why they do these ceremonies to sort of keep the spirits away, keep them happy, keep them at bay. Not entirely unlike the residents of Odo Island with Gojira. I love the spooky stuff in the forest with like the skeleton hands and the ghosts and everything. I love it. It's cool. It's spooky. I love spooky. Give me more spooky, please.
When the ghosts rose up, that was just like a, whoa, wait, what? Where did this come from? I was not expecting that at all. They look pretty cool too. It's very sort of Darby O'Gill, a little bit Ghostbusters-ish, definitely water tank effects. But, like, yeah, that came out of nowhere. And the funny thing is, this would be you'd think where I'd go into my usual, you know, well, wait, was it a ghost ship or a real ship? What's going on, Matango? Kind of, you know, rant. But it's funny. It was even more out of nowhere than there. But somehow here, I think because of the way it was framed. Like, I love with the skeleton hand. And then, in fact, I even missed this and my wife had me rewind it. But it, like, he brushes it away. It goes down and then comes back up still bouncing. And it's just a branch. And it gives you just that ambiguity of, like, is this just a freaked out kid's imagination? Or is there really something here that just, you know, only appears to you and then disappears again? Like, was there a real skeleton that then disguised itself as a branch? Or was it just his overactive imagination because he's scared turning a branch into a skeleton hand in his mind? Like, I loved the way that it was so ambiguously framed. Even though it was out of nowhere, instead of confusing me, it just felt like it made everything more awesome, especially because it was almost just this shot of adrenaline into the middle of a movie where it's like, okay, I guess despite that freaky opening, we're not really going to have any supernatural events here. A lot of people talking about it, but until the monster shows up, it's just going to be very ordinary and, you know, regular human world. And then suddenly, whoa, out of left field. And it puts the film, it sort of puts it on a new pacing. It throws it onto a new track where you don't know what to expect anymore. You thought you had it figured out, and suddenly it's surprising you.
Give me all the spooky things, more spooky things.
I thought the quick cutting of, like, animal eyes and mouths was really effectively unsettling. Like, it was nice, just cheap, you know, low budget filmmaking used well. And like Super Monster, I really respect when they use nice, cheap techniques to craft something really effective that didn't cost them a dime, but really hits home the way it's meant to. So that was really well done.
So, yeah, the scene where they attempt to break the statue and then everything, all hell breaks loose on them, was really awesome. It's like, I think for me, that's where the film really picked up. Like, as soon as the statue started bleeding, that is the moment where, to me, this film gets on another level.
Yeah, the part where they're hitting it with sledgehammers, I was kind of chuckling at because they were pulling their punches to not damage the plaster prop a little too obviously. But then when they get the idea of the chisel and it goes in and then it starts to bleed and you're like, oh no, here we go. Like, yeah. First of all, you're just like, oh crap. And then second of all, it's just like, this cannot be going anywhere good for them.
Yeah.
It's just so much portent and anticipation and fear wrapped up in that moment of just like, oh no, what are we getting into here?
You know, it's kind of interesting the way that these movies parallel Godzilla versus the Sea Monster from the same year, with that movie's heroes having to awaken Godzilla in order to overcome the oppressive forces of red bamboo.
And then they just get absolutely wrecked. Like the ground opens up and like there's just this yellow light coming out of the ground and then he falls in and then the ground closes. It's so awesome. Like I said, like the ground splits open and like swallows Gunjiro and it's just the whole scene is insane.
Yeah, it's kind of cool to see the statue bleed and it's kind of unexpected almost because, I don't know, you would think maybe, okay, the statue's going to break and then the mountain will shake and then he'll come out of the mountain or you'll hear a roar or something will happen. But to see like all of a sudden just blood start to run down, it's very unsettling. It's very creepy. And honestly, what I was going to say earlier, you know, segueing from creepy is his eyes. Like whoever made the call to make Daimajin the size that he is, and to make his face and his design the way he is, deserves some sort of like recognition because his eyes and his facial expressions are absolutely terrifying and intimidating and perfect. And the only thing I can think of that somewhat matches it is Gaira from War of the Gargantuas. That's the only thing I can think of that comes even remotely close to that level of terrifying and intimidating from another Suitmation kaiju.
I'm actually really glad you mentioned that, Parker, because I actually have a very interesting fun fact about that. I agree. I love the way Daimajin looked, that like really classic, like unsettling, like sculpted rage of like classic Japanese art. But again, the eyes were really, really grabbing. And so I looked up how they got that effect. The mask is actually see-through. Those are the actual eyes of the suit actor, Riki Hashimoto. And they did the same thing with Gaira, and such a good effect. It was just like, it really makes it unsettling. And like really lets the acting come through.
Yeah, I loved that. I was just in awe of Daimajin the entire time he was on screen. He looks so pissed off. Like, this is the most pissed off I think I've ever seen, like, a monster express in its face, you know? It's so good, and he does not hold back when he's attacking.
I feel like that face is very interesting to me. Like, I can't decide if he's supposed to have, like, an ogre's green flesh in metal armor, or if that's just supposed to be almost like an ornate statue with human-style eyes behind a jade mask atop a carved stone body. Like, I can't decide whether he's supposed to be living stone and gem as a statue still, or if he's supposed to be actual animate flesh. But it's a great look, and the transition from, like, blank stone face to angry mode. Like, I feel like the effect could be achieved just a little better in modern day, because you could mask that nice and cleanly instead of sort of having a crossfade hidden by the swipe. But yeah, it's an actual relief, especially again for my wife, when he puts on his happy face again at the end of the movie and you're like, oh, okay, thank goodness, it's over.
And you also have, like, this, when he does it, like, you have, like, the thunder clapping and the sky gets dark and, like, it's literally, it's really terrifying. Like, the whole thing is really freaky. And the sky is dark and cloudy and scary and everything. And then when he's done, you get that nice, like, sunrise. And, you know, yeah, like you were saying, he kind of swipes his head back and it goes back to that normal stone face. You're like, whew, okay, cool, he's good now, everything's fine. But the amount of emotion in his eyes, like, even when he's not in a rage killing machine mode, like, even when he's like not, like, he's about to step on the girl and he stops, like, there's just so much emotion in his eyes. It's all just done so exceptionally well. And I feel like if he was in it more, it would probably be less effective. But, like, seeing as he's in it for such a little amount of time, it just hits you so hard. It's so well done.
It's the Godzilla 2014 principle, like we talked about back during the road to Godzilla versus Kong.
Another thing about his eyes is when he's getting ready to kill Samanosuke, his eyes widen, and it's so good. Like, the suit actor is able to convey so much with his eyes, and it's so great.
Another bit I really loved with the eye acting was when they start throwing the rocks at him in the fire, just before he, like, does that magic ghost swipe to get rid of all the fire so he can just get by, his eyes, like, I don't know if it's because of fire or something, but his eyes, like, squint, like he's just, like, annoyed, and it's just, like, oh, it gave me chills. Again, Poet Parker, that's right. If it was more of him, it probably wouldn't have worked, but, like, it just hits you so hard. It really does feel like there's this, like, living God spirit who's just going raging against everyone.
I have to say, to me, for all the buildup, the actual awakening was kind of anticlimactic. Like, it was a little bit, oh, that's it, he stands up and some rocks fall away. Like, It was just kind of, oh, whatever. Again, until he goes angry face, and then you're like, oh, it's on. And even then, during the rampage to me, I felt like he himself was imposing. But I found a lot of his rampaging just kind of unexciting. It just felt very conventional. There wasn't any wow factor. But that moment that you mentioned where he just makes that gesture and all the flames go out, then it's like, then he kicked it into high gear. It's just like, oh, okay, this is more than just monster stomp through miniatures. There, he's doing more than just wrecking the place as we expected from the moment we saw the movie poster. Like, he's about to start really kicking things up a notch. So that for me was also the moment that just made me go like, oh, you know, just get kind of the chills.
And speaking of those miniatures, they are excellent. Like, and I think this kind of helps because of the scale, because he's, and I think you guys mentioned this in the Gamera the Brave episode, where the having smaller kaiju allows you to do a lot more with your effects, because if things are produced on a larger scale, you can have a lot more detail there. And I think that is really shown here, because they have so much detail, and especially like when he picks up some of the people, like it just looks so much better. It just looks so cool. It just looks cool.
Miniatures here were built at a 1 to 2.5 scale, which, for example, is about 10 times the size of the miniatures in the original Godzilla. So you're able to just incorporate a lot more detail at that scale. And it also meant that in addition to Riki Hashimoto's outstanding performance inside the Majin costume, he really uses his eyes marvelously. Hot take here, but I would say better than Nakajima and Sekita did in War of the Gargantuas.
I mean, that said, I did feel like his size was a little inconsistent throughout the rampage in some shots, but it was really well done, especially when that one shot they were charging what looked like it was like a full-sized animatronic. Like, it was really stiff, only the arms were moving, but it let them get this versatile camera movement like they were just handheld reporters on the ground at, like, a breaking news scene. They could just follow the people charging in toward this giant, full-sized Daimajin.
That's my favorite shot in the movie. It's just so good because you have the guys all in the foreground, and then, you know, you've got Daimajin sort of, I guess, in the midground, and then the sky behind him is like almost like black at the top and then kind of red towards the bottom, and it looks really cool. And then, like, he has his arm kind of raised, like his fist sort of raised, like in front of his chest, and then he puts his arm down, and the wind, and it just causes the wind to blow and knock all of the guys over, and then he just starts trampling them, and it's just crazy.
You can do that, unlike, you know, the Cybot Godzilla foot or the full-sized 70s Kong that broke down and started urinating oil in the middle of the shoot, because you have him at a much more manageable scale.
Right. They were able to build a full-scale Majin prop with individual removable pieces. So there'd be a staff member inside that prop who could operate the head, the eyes, and the right arm. If you're looking for it, you can pick out where they use the prop and not the suit, because the movements are significantly more limited and because the eyes are obviously not human. But they don't overplay their hand with the prop, and the two techniques work together pretty seamlessly. There's also outstanding optical work at play here. I would say that the compositing of live actors and Majin into shots together is at least as impressive, maybe more impressive, than the work Toho was doing at the time. Honestly, given the technology available at the time, this is pretty flawless compositing.
Yeah, having his giant hand crushing Simonosuke's, like, other lieutenant in the bit, like, he just looks out the window and sees his right-hand man getting killed. That looked amazing because of what they were able to do with the scale of that hand being much closer to a person, so you could make the effect a lot more personal instead of having to have a guy in a suit pick up a little unarticulated doll.
The rampage just clicks with me because, like, how unnatural it is. Like, he's just moving slowly, ponderously, like he doesn't even care about anything that's attacking him. He has his target. He knows where Samanosuke is, and he's going to go murder that guy. Everything else just in his way. It's just like, it really feels so creepy. And like, even some of the little, what I think were probably supposed to be inconsistencies work like that, like his size changing and like the wind stuff, it feels so wrong. It feels like I should not be seeing this. This is something from another world that I'm looking at here. Another little thing I want to add, because I was reminded of it by Andrew saying about seeing him choke out the, well, not choke, crush the other lieutenant in his hand, is there's this great, that great bit where, like, he, where Samusuke jumps away from the hand, and then it, there's another one behind him. It really gives that ghost thing where they can kind of, like, move. Like, it reminded me of Jason Voorhees. Like, it just teleports instantly behind you just when you think you're away from it. I don't have words. It's just so good.
Just before that, after he watches that guy get crushed, and then he's looking at Daimajin through the window, and Daimajin just, like, he just slowly turns his head and stares down Samunosuke, and Samunosuke is clearly just, like,
Daimajin
himself, and I would be too. Like, that would just be terrifying.
Yeah, the cool thing about this whole rampage was that, look, we've had plenty of kaiju have rampages in the city, but with very few exceptions, are those rampages personal? Like, there's not that many. I mean, you could say the original Gojira is personal. You could say GMK has some sort of personal elements to it.
Gorgo?
Yeah, sure, and maybe parts of Godzilla versus King Ghidorah, but for the most part, a lot of these aren't personal. This was personal. Daimajin is pissed, and it's you almost start to feel sorry for the guys, like, especially when they finally, like, they retreat back behind the gates and they start shoving all the guys behind onto the other side of the gates while they're closing it. And, like, there's this sense of, like, panic. I started to get stressed out, and I've seen it before, but I still started getting stressed out because it's scary to watch, because you're like, this guy is coming for you no matter what. And you don't want to be stomped on, crushed, thrown, impaled, like when he impales the other guy. Like, there's so much to it. It's really, really quite scary to watch.
That aspect of this rampage, for me, makes this, like, the most cathartic monster rampage I think I've ever seen. It just gives me... It makes me feel so much more satisfied at the end of it than anything else I've seen. And then, of course, Daimajin just nailing Samunosuke to that wall or whatever with the stake that was driven into his forehead is so awesome.
I did feel like the shot of Samunosuke being carried past the regulars was, like, A for effort. The execution didn't quite work in that shot. But then just having him carried over, having had that giant chisel sticking out of his head the whole time, only to pull it out and use it to kill the bad guy, that was just, like, you know, that's a MonsterVerse-level coup de grace of just, like, we have to figure out a spectacular way to end this fight. Really, that was an amazing way to end it. That was even better than if we'd gotten Nelson blown off of Mount Fuji.
Right. I like how throughout this series, however the villain is planning on killing the good guys, that's how Majin eventually does him in.
To bring up the GMK comparisons again, this reminds me of that one scene in that film where Godzilla's roaring, this lady screams, and he just turns and starts going after her specifically. This is just, like, such a terrifying idea. There is this thing millions of times bigger than you, and it has you on
Daimajin
list. It doesn't have... It'll kill some people in this way, yeah, but it doesn't... You specifically are the one it wants dead, and it is not going to stop until you are dead, no matter what anyone throws at it, and that is just terrifying. I want a whole movie about that. Some guy pisses off some, like, kaiju god, and he's, like, fleeing the country as it's just destroying the world trying to get to him. It's just so, ugh.
I mean, we get that in Mothra, I guess.
That is true.
Yeah, I agree. Like, that makes it so much more scary. Like, a giant monster attack is already a scary concept in and of itself, but, like, knowing that it's coming after you, like, that's just horrifying. And it just makes me think of the scene in Pacific Rim where Newt Geisler's in that bunker and he's like, you don't understand. You don't understand. It's trying to get me. The only other thing I wanted to mention was I really like the moment where they try to use those chains to restrain Daimajin as, you know, he's rampaging. And then he just pulls the chains and just destroys the surrounding buildings that they're tied to. And it's just fantastic.
I think it's very interesting. Parker, you mentioned him as being like an embodiment of vengeance. And the thing is that you feel like after Samano Suke is dead, he is going to keep on going. Like, he's punished the guilty, but he doesn't draw any line. The guilty was just first on his list, or maybe they were just the ones that happened to be standing there as the city's defender. Like, you almost get the feeling if Kojenta had been joining in trying to defend the city, he would have been dead too. Like, he did come and he rescued the brother specifically, knocking over his cross, which seemed like it might have actually been enough to kill him, and we don't even see him land, but apparently that saved him. But then, to me, it's interesting that, at least from my perspective, you don't know if he relents because Kosaza is the one who called on him and her tears are like moving him, or because of her protective charm, which they very specifically on the soundtrack put in that jingle as she goes there and she has just, you know, reclaimed that it protects her. And so it's almost like a supernatural barrier, and that's what breaks him out of his rampage state. Like, I feel like they leave it ambiguous. Is he a good guy that feels for her the same way, you know, or is he a monster that was awakened because of the curse of the priestess and her calling for vengeance and is not moved emotionally by these things, doesn't care, but there's a protective charm that halts him, and that's enough to be like, okay, my job here is done. Like, I feel like it makes him a very ambiguous figure as a monster, and whether he's sort of there to help out of nobility or if he is just destruction unleashed, and that happened to have been enough to basically to calm the Hulk down back into Bruce Banner.
Honestly, I haven't watched the sequels in a very long time. And I know that technically, following my own rules, those wouldn't really have any bearing on this. Because, I mean, you can always change things in sequels, whatever. But I don't remember if they ever really go into that anymore. But watching it this time, I certainly got the impression, at least, that he was going through, destroying everything, and he was just pissed off. Like, I don't know if he was pissed off because his ceremony was not finished or taken seriously, or if the priestess was killed, or if people weren't worshiping him. Like, because, I mean, there's a whole couple of different things here. Or if he was woken up, or the you know, maybe he had a splitting headache. Like, whatever it was, he was angry. He was furious. Now, I don't know if he would have stopped, but it's hard because in the movie, like, he doesn't really, like, they make a point to show you the teardrop on his foot. Like, they make a point to show you that teardrop falls on him. So was it, like, you know, the innocence that stopped him? Was it that charm? Was it just, okay, you know what? We're cool. I'll go back now. I agree. It is kind of interesting. You don't really quite know, and it's sort of up to viewer discretion how you want to interpret it. But I sort of interpreted it this time that, you know what? He was just angry. He was wrathful. He probably would have kept going and have just destroyed everything that this guy had built, had touched, and was a part of, and then may have gone back to the mountain to rest.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Parker. I feel like Daimajin's would have kept going. He wouldn't have kept going until Kazuzo, the princess, would have did that final, like, she, like, begged him one last time to stop. And I feel like it's kind of like, again, it's ambiguous why. I think he's kind of, like, imbuing that kind of gray morality you usually get with, like, ghosts and fairies and these other kind of supernatural things, where, like, it could be anything. It could have been, like, he only punishes the guilty, and he considered those who didn't do as much to fight back against Samanosuke guilty, or he just decided that they're all guilty because they lived by the mountain that's haunted, or who knows. It's really, I don't know, it's just very interesting how ambiguous he is. Like, he's like the most mysterious of all the kaiju I can think of, because like he's just not, he's just a, he's like a ghost or a horror villain. You don't know what his deal is, you just know a bit about him.
So, let's move on to the score. This film's score was composed by none other than the legendary Akira Ifukube. And kind of similarly to Terror of Mechagodzilla's score, this one is kind of repetitive, I felt like. It just kind of cycled through like the same like three or four themes throughout the movie. And I noticed that every theme that I at least picked up on kind of reappears in Godzilla films, which, you know, Akira Ifukube is no stranger to reusing scores, but it really stuck out to me here how much the themes in this film are reused. Like, I think like the opening notes in the very beginning of the film. Were, I guess, taken from Godzilla vs. Monster Zero. I don't know if they showed up before that movie, but that's what I know them from. And then, like, the Daimajin theme. Is very, very similar to the Godzilla March. And there were a couple themes that come back in Godzilla versus King Ghidorah. Like, there's one theme in the film, I think the first time it shows up is whenever the house or whatever they were in burns down. That I think is part of M11's theme. And then there's another theme that shows up a lot. Specifically, I remember it showing up whenever they see the Daimajin statue in the woods when they first arrive. If I'm remembering right, was used during Godzilla Saurus' death in Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah. So, yeah, I just thought that was interesting and was something that I wanted to point out.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this was just completely 100% generic Ifukube of the era. Like, it sounded incredibly close to just the same sound style of, you know, King Kong versus Godzilla, Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster. Any of the other films of this period, there were so many themes that sounded just a note or two off from the exact fare we were getting in those movies, especially Godzilla ripoff-y, you know, feeling during the Rampage. It just felt very standard and rote. It had his stock sound, but there was nothing particularly inspired or standout about it. It's not that it didn't have any original compositions, it just didn't have any particularly memorable ones, and it's just like 100% him, exactly, perfectly indicative of all of his output from this era, but it just sounded like everything we've already heard before.
I thought it worked pretty well for the movie, though. Like, I feel like generic Ifukube is still pretty good Ifukube.
I agree with everything Nick and Andrew have been saying. Yeah, it's really good, but it kind of sounds like every other Ifukube score.
It's a Ifukube. It's good, but it's also, like, if this was the only Ifukube soundtrack that we've ever had, it would be incredible. But in the long history of Ifukube scores, it's good. It's not a bad soundtrack by any stretch of the imagination. It's just there's not really anything memorable. Like, nothing comes to mind. The only actually, there's only one thing that comes to mind, and that's this sort of, like, for lack of a better term, like a death march sort of thing. This melancholy sort of song that played as they were walking towards the mountain after the coup had taken place. As they were taking the kids to the mountain. That is the only theme that sort of stuck with me. But yeah, it was sort of like, oh, cool, okay. 60s of Fukube music. Cool. Yeah, it's not bad. It's just there's nothing that, like, really stands out to me.
So are we ready to move on to Stray Thoughts?
I felt like the opening was really strong and atmospheric, with everyone just kind of, like, watching in fear, mustering a ritual that seems, like, somewhat familiar to them. Like, you get the sense that they have done this on a semi-regular basis throughout the generations. It's a known thing, but it's still very frightening. And then the ceremony itself, it was just a really strong introduction to the concept of the mountain god and to the village. Like, you don't really get any protagonist characters in there. It switches from perspective to perspective, but it gives you an overview of the people, of the village, that thread of the tapestry. It gives you a sense of the people whose land is about to be overtaken by this tyrant. And it also introduces the supernatural concepts with a sense of foreboding. It serves a very good double duty of establishing everything it needs to really quickly, because we sort of get right into the coup. And it gives you a sense of what is being lost and, you know, what other forces may be at play here really fast before moving into the plot proper.
The only thing that really stood out to me, aside from the things that I mentioned, one would be I found the whole atmosphere in general, the whole color palette of the film, I think is just really gorgeous, even in its creepy muted grays in the beginning. There's just something very beautiful about the film.
I mean, yeah, it's an extremely well shot movie. Apparently Yasuda was known for being a very exacting visual director, and he was a good artist and drew his own storyboards. I haven't seen anything else that was shot by Fujio Morita, the director of photography. He and Yasuda both did a lot of Zatoichi movies, but I did find that Morita was a camera assistant on Kurosawa's Rashomon.
A weird little random last note, but that waterfall where a lot takes place is really gorgeous, and the way it's shot from the base, just the general look of it is slightly like foggy lens and everything. It felt very Krull. Like, if you've seen the movie Krull, which I highly recommend, I love that movie, it's very much in that style, sort of a very 80s fantasy look to it.
Yeah, I thought the waterfall was beautiful too.
It seems like quite a feat to us that Daiei was able to put out all three of these movies in a single year, but bear in mind, 3 to 4 months was not an unusually short span of time for a movie to be made in Japan at the time. Look at the number of movies Ishiro Honda was directing per year from like the mid-50s into the mid-60s. And these sorts of period things were such standard fare for Japanese studios at the time. Putting together the sets and costumes was just business as usual, like an American studio doing a Western in the 40s or 50s.
I thought the costume design in this movie was really great. Particularly young Tadafumi with his robes that are kind of purple on the top and then it sort of fades into white, and Kozasa as an adult with her like sort of two-toned like orange robes with like the flowers on it. I thought the characters in this looked really good.
Going back to what I mentioned earlier about the Christian imagery, where do we sit on this? Like, it's kind of, I don't want to say bizarre because that feels like an insulting term to say, but like it's interesting because I feel like you have like Evangelion, which has loads of Christian imagery in it, but and things here and there, but it just seems sort of, I don't know, like what's the implications of it to have like two guys on a cross and to have the last guy nailed to a cross? Like, it's all very, I don't know, not what I would expect from a Japanese film, if I'm making any sense here.
Obviously, I would love nothing better than for there to be a strong Christian presence in Japan, and I'm sure that there are some, but a lot of it, I have to wonder if it's more of a cultural contagion, like we were talking about with the Happy Birthday song on Zone Fighter, just something that a lot of the occupying servicemen and contractors rebuilding and everything post-World War II brought into Japanese culture. It became an influence. It was a familiar thing, especially back during that era where it would be more common for the everyman to be talking about, unlike today. And it just sort of became a known thing. And I sometimes the way that it's used, I think it may fascinate somewhat in Japan because it's so different from the cultural ideas and religious ideas that they grew up around. But sometimes the way that it's used in a film like this, which I did find kind of uncomfortable, if it's almost more like when we have shirts that have some cool-looking Chinese or Japanese writing on it, and then it turns out it says mustard or water or whatever, and we don't know. It just looks like cool letters to us, but we're not using it, like, literally to form a coherent. We're just using the parts of it that look cool to us and putting them in a context that seems appropriate to us, but not really using them the way they were intended or in any context that would make sense, like just having a shirt that says water to an actual native speaker. You know, I kind of wonder if it's almost like that. Like, these are interesting stories that entered the cultural consciousness during that post-World War II period, and they take the parts that they find very interesting because they're so different, or recognize that they may be profound to certain viewers or have a certain global familiarity because of how widely Christianity is known, if not necessarily adhered to. And so they use those images where they think they will have an impact, but not really in any way that makes a special sense to those for whom that imagery and those beliefs are actually a way of life. It's just sort of, you know what I mean?
It's sort of been, it's detached from the culture and it's done more as a, what's interesting, so you, yeah, I got what you're going for. I think it's interesting that, like, it, like we had mentioned earlier, it comes up in Mothra. There's other occasional instances where it's brought up about, like, God and praying, and like I said, about Evangelion is absolutely loaded with imagery. So it is interesting that it does come up often, but I think you're right. I think it's sort of just like, it's sort of navigated over there, and they're sort of just, it's sort of being used in such a way that it's an attempt to do something spiritual and mystical, but they're not, it's not quite clicking because it's not something that it's not raised in the culture. It's not the core of that society over there. Now, granted, it's not the core of my moral compass, but it's also what I was raised with. So, like, I am still familiar with the stories. I'm familiar with Christianity in general, as I'm sure most of us, even if we aren't all varying degrees of faith, I'm sure we're all at least familiar with them. Like, it's still something that we're so familiar with it that you see across, you know, exactly what it is. For someone of in Japan, it isn't necessarily that way. It's, or it may not, it may be. But I don't know. It's just, it's interesting that it kind of just pops up. And when it was, they kept talking about God, like a capital G God. Like, it wasn't the mountain God constantly. And I found that distinction very fascinating.
And I also wonder how much of that is the cultural bias or viewpoint of the translator into English versus how much was originally intended.
Fair. Yeah, that's fair.
It definitely seems like they're taking the idea of a regional god, which is a very common concept all the way back to antiquity in many cultures across the globe, but sort of taking very traditional Japanese spiritualism of, you know, gods and shrines and, you know, certain things, but combining it with the capital G god of Christianity, of a more singular global authoritarian bearer of justice, you know, it's sort of fusing the two. And again, I wonder how much of that was the Japanese screenwriters fusing the two versus somebody that doesn't really understand the way that the Japanese view gods being the person that translated this film into English. But I don't know. So it's just amusing.
No, I'm with you.
Not amusing as in funny. It is a space musing.
It's interesting. It's interesting.
What I was going to say based off my search on this topic from me being interested in this very same conversation based off Evangelion and Mothra is, well, basically you guys kind of nailed it. It's like a little bit of using universal iconography, a little bit of like stuff that that like we've been translated to fit our current standards, well, not our current standards and like the exoticism of it. In particular, I think the main reason they used crosses was, again, that it's like a very interesting exoticism. Like, again, as Parker was saying, it's everywhere in Evangelion. And I know for a fact that Ijai Superaya, a devout Catholic, was very fascinated by the iconography of the cross. So it became kind of a trope in the early Ultraman shows that heroes would get crucified and that he would attack with like that cross-shaped beam. So I think it is really interesting as like Westerner to look in and see how like this thing we all grow up with is kind of interpreted from this completely different culture. So I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying like it's a very, very interesting thing to see. And I think Daimaj in particular really kind of blurred the line between, because like, yeah, I'm gonna agree. I don't know if it's just a dub, but I mean not the dub, the subs, but I was really starting to get confused if they were talking about the capital G god or like a god. And it's, I don't know, it's very interesting.
Was Eiji Tsuburaya really a Catholic or was that like sarcasm?
Yes. No.
Oh.
He's actually a devout Catholic for his whole life.
I had no idea. That's interesting.
Yeah, I read it in the August Ragone book.
I didn't know that either.
I'm always learning stuff in this podcast. I'm so glad we started this thing.
We're educational, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually where part of the reason that Cross come up so much in Evangelion, because besides Anno loving the iconography himself, he's a huge Ultra fan, and he saw it in those shows. He's like, wow, I'd love to use more of that in my stuff.
You know, it's funny, though, ruminating on this strange appropriation of Christian symbology, which does continue into future Daimajin movies. And you would think that that's just something unique, like we've just been discussing, the Japanese culture and maybe even to its era. But then in Godzilla versus Kong, we get that moment where Kong is leaping up toward the big carving of the ape hand with the pointing finger. And they're like recreating Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel with, you know, Adam and God for no apparent thematic reason whatsoever in the movie. Like, and even if you try and symbolically kind of link it to Origins, it's like, again, it's not, he's not meeting his God or his maker. He's just finding his ancestor's house. Like, I don't know. Apparently, for whatever reason, this weird appropriation of Christian or Christian adjacent symbology is still happening in modern American productions too. So it's just something inherent to giant monster movies rather than to Japan. Weird.
So it's time to decide who each of us thinks is the MVP of this film. For me, I'm going to have to go with the special effects director, Yoshiyuki Kuroda. Just, again, everything from that composite shot of the eye at the beginning of the film to the scene where they try to break the statue and all hell breaks loose to, of course, Daimajin's rampage. Everything is just incredible. And the effects in this movie are really just something else. And they're some of the best that I've seen in the genre, especially in the early years of it.
I think for me, it would be Otome Tsukimiya as the priestess Shinobu. I feel like while this film is constructed as such as it does not need a protagonist, it does still need an emotional anchor, and I feel like that's her. I feel like she is the strong presence, the through line, and the real emotional connection. Thankfully, the Miwa Takada is there to take the hand off as the princess once she is gone to become sort of a new emotional center of the film. But for much of it, Shinobu carries it, and to me, I feel like this film would not work without her strong presence in it.
I agree with Andrew. I love Shinobu, but I'm going to give my MVP to Chikara Riki Hashimoto as Daimajin. I've said it before, he was just incredible. Some of the best dude acting I've seen outside of like the Toho greats like Nakajima. Just perfect. The eye acting, that like slow menacing walk, it's just great. Though again, I'll also have to throw it into the I already forgot the name, special effect director for that, creating that incredible Daimajin suit that just looks so real.
I'm gonna have to say my MVP would be Chikara Hashimoto as well. I feel like this entire movie would completely fall apart if you did not have that performance convincing enough. If you didn't have Daimajin's vengeance and wrath and anger just completely and utterly convincing the way it is in his performance, in his eyes, in his hand motions, in the way he walks, in the way he hits buildings, in the way he grabs things. This entire film would deflate like a balloon if you did not have that. Everything else is important. Everything else is good. But I feel like that performance is the energy that runs, that powers this film to its core.
I do want to say that the entire time I was watching the movie, I was convinced that Otome Tsukimiya was also going to be my MVP, and then the rampage happened and I had to give it to Yoshiyuki Kuroda once that rampage happened.
So you guys have already named both of my first two choices for MVP. So just in the interest of variety, I'm going to go with a third closely related option. Designer Ryu Takayama, whose lovely sketches of the character of Daimajin were faithfully translated to the screen. I really think the look of the character goes a long way toward making this movie work. I mean, he's pretty intimidating to behold. So, you know, thank you, Ryu Takayama.
We've covered Daimajin about as good as we can. So let's all go around and give our final thoughts.
I liked it. It is not traditional. It again, no protagonist. It's so much more about plot than character. Each of the little people as vignettes. But I respect that. That is very different. And the ending kaiju action is some of the most inspired and standout that I've seen in the era. Like, I would put this up there with Hedora or Dagora in terms of like, wow, that stands out from the pack. That is showing me something that I have not seen in one of these movies before. That is some really, really great stuff. Imaginative imagery with incredibly strong technical execution. It feels like it's just a regular samurai movie up until you get to that haunted forest, and then it starts to hint at something more. And I don't know, there's something indefinable about it that didn't quite click with me for part of it, but I can't really put my finger on that, and I can put my finger on so many things that I thought were done so well. So this is not like my new favorite movie, but I'd be hard-pressed to tell you why, and it is certainly one that gets very high marks for me because I can really only think of positives for this one. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
It's a really good movie. It's got a strong, distinctive concept, and it's pulled off in a compelling, entertaining way with a lot of atmosphere and just an absolutely fantastic final 10 minutes or so.
This is definitely one that I appreciate more as I've watched it. This is only my second time watching it, but I look forward to watching it again. And actually now I want to rewatch the sequels again. I enjoy its atmosphere very much. I enjoy its themes of good and evil and right and wrong. And I love the wrath of Daimajin at the end. I just think it's a very easily digestible film. I think it's very entertaining. It's a little bit of a slow burn, but it's got perfect payoff. I just think there's a lot to enjoy here. I wouldn't say it's one of my favorites of all time, but it's definitely one of the more unique entries out there and very much worth your time.
Such an incredible movie. Great drama. Great acting, especially from Makome Tsukimiya and Riki Hashimoto. Just incredible effects. Such a great monster. Again, I gotta say, if you want to see something new in the kaiju genre that no one's talking about, this is definitely your pick.
Yeah, I want to personally thank the Random Number Generator for having us talk about this film. I think Brendan was saying earlier that he heard that it was good, but he didn't expect it to be this good. And I'm kind of in the same boat, but it really is just kind of the rampage at the end that kind of really puts it over the top. Like, I wasn't super hot on most of the characters aside from the priestess and like the princess, but you know, that's all serviceable. Like, I think that's all pretty good and enjoyable, and the villains were great, so they kind of also helped carry me through that. But man, just that rampage and the special effects and everything. Like, once those guys put the stake through the statue's head, this movie just takes off and it just becomes absolutely incredible. And it really is something different in the genre. And if you are listening to this and you for some reason haven't watched it yet, go do it, please. It's on YouTube for free. Like, you can just go on YouTube and watch it. It's fantastic, seriously. If you love yourself, watch Daimajin.
Even though there will be literally no surprises left after this episode of our podcast.
Yeah, but you know. It's still good.
It's like Star Wars. You know what's going to happen from pop culture and other people, but it's still that good.
So that will wrap up our discussion on Daimajin. And next week, we are back with our old favorite Zone Fighter. It has been a while, and it was so good to get back into it last time. So we will press on into the 20s and move very close to the end of this series we're having so much fun with. We hope that you will join us for a few more last hurrahs. In the meantime, if you want to get in contact with us about this Zone Fighter or any other of our podcasts, feel free to drop us a line at gforcekaijupod@gmail.com, at facebook.com/gforcekaijupod, or just search GForce in the search bar, or on Instagram or Twitter at gforcekaijupod. We like to keep consistent branding.
So because Daimajin was initially supposed to be a Gamera villain, we're going to go around and discuss which monster we would like to see Daimajin fight.
I've been Brendan, and I'd like to see Daimajin fight Rodan for exact reasons you would think a flying monster would fight a statue.
I've been Nick, and due to the conversation we had earlier, I would really now like to see Daimajin team up with Godzilla to fight Mechagodzilla.
I've been Andrew, and I'm going to take it the opposite direction. I would love to see Daimajin versus King Caesar, Battle of the Alarm Clocks.
I've been Evan, and I would really like to see Daimajin face another humanoid kaiju with very expressive human eyes showing and a green face. I would like to see Daimajin versus the gargantua Gaira.
I've been Parker, and I want to see Daimajin versus the sea monster, just so I could watch that evil grimace rip down on that furry, weird neck as he pummels him into a nice, buttery dinner.
Is that how it said? Daimajin? I thought Daimajin or Daimijin.
Listening to the way they say it in the movie, I'm pretty sure I heard it as Daimajin.
Well, honestly, what would G-Force, a kaiju podcast, be without me stubbornly mispronouncing things the way that I read them in my head for the whole episode? So if a Daimajin slips by, you'll know why. And Princess Kozaza to... And Princess Kozaza, the Z and then the S is throwing me. And Princess Kozaza to safety amidst the violence. Kojenta's... oh, gosh.
Let me move over to Wikipedia so I can read the cast.
That guy, this guy, that chick, that kid, priestess.
You know, you can pretty much go with that kid and priestess. And the rest are here on Gilligan's Isle.
No, there's that girl, the girl who cries on the statue.
That's true. She becomes important. She is not even there in the first half of the movie, but she becomes important in the second half.
Yeah, she goes very... I'm like, okay, this is kind of a minor character. And then, poof, she's literally, like, the standout character.
Daimajin was like, I don't recognize you, but you seem pretty upset about something. I'll go away.
They all react once Daimajin actually awakens and, like, their hopes in Daimajin. Daimajin, I'm just going to change pronunciation mid-sentence, but yeah.
It exists, it's like vanilla ice cream. It's really good. It's really, really good, but it's vanilla. It's nothing. See, I say that, but I really like vanilla ice cream.
Yeah.
Let me redo that, because I really like vanilla ice cream. I'm insulting vanilla ice cream right now. The vanilla ice cream gods would be ashamed.
Tsukimiya was also going to be my MVP. And then the rampage happened, and I had to give it to, I already forget his name. 1 second.
Great job, Nick.
They're, you know, obviously they're Japanese names, so I'm not super familiar with them. But, like, they're so much longer and more complex than, like, a lot of the names that pop up in Godzilla movies. So, like, I keep having to reread them. Shizuhiro Izugu...
We really need just a Mark Jackson in here.
I know. Shizuhiro Izoguchi as Takebo, aka the boy. That's exactly what Wikipedia says. Okay.
Oh boy, we are in rare form tonight, Nick.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry, Parker.
Well, just here's the good news, guys. We're not going to have to worry about that for the next several months, because we're going straight up MonsterVerse.
Okay.
Featuring Aaron Taylor Johnson as
King of the Monsters, starring Killul Chandler, Mealy Booby Brown,
and Booby Brown.
Churl
and Ken Watanabe. Yeah, and we'd have to make sure you get the Ken Watanabe. It would be perfectly right. Everything else would be, you'd have a really hard time doing, but Ken Watanabe, totally fine. But I'm sorry, guys. I don't know how to say this one.
Tom Metal Teach.
The one thing is, I have no idea what to do for our ending.
Me neither. We really got to start figuring that out beforehand.
Planning it in advance, darn it. Yeah.
What kind of gin do you like?
I don't drink.
What color would you dye your gin? I would dye my gin. Thank you. I'm here for another 10 minutes. What about, like, what kind of statue would you want if you were a wrathful god?
Or you could be like, how would you want Daimajin to kill you?
What would you take?
Daimajin.
Nick?
What?
How do you want to die in 2021?
Hey guys, hope you like the podcast. How do you like to die?
Dude, I will never forget Evan's Matango
I was going to say, some of the outros get pretty dark already.
It was like, I'll go out into the woods and like just sit by myself and merge into the, like, it was something like really dark, and we're all just like, okay. You okay, Evan?
God, that was so funny.
That was great. Or what do you think it would take to awaken Daimajin, you know, like now? I mean, because if he hasn't woken up yet, I mean...
Maybe he has, and he's just like taking a while. Like, okay, take care of these guys who didn't.
Yeah, he's just like he can't choose. He's just not gonna cross or it's going. This way.
How about since he was made as a Gamera villain? What if we had to like, I don't know, who would you like to see Daimajin fight? Who would you like to see Daimajin? Who would win in a fight, Daimajin or Zygra? But we all know it'd be Zygra.
But,
I mean, I don't know. This is, if that's how he was made, you know.
No, I like that one.
I'm down.
Boom. Looking for this. I've been Parker, and I want to see Daimajin versus the sea monster, just so I could watch that evil grimace grip down on that furry, weird neck as he pummels him into a nice buttery dinner.
Man, don't make me want seafood right now, dude.
It's always
glowing orange spaghetti.
Oh man. Glowing orange spaghetti, but
just,
with like,
just picture Daimajin all pissed off holding Ebra, who's going as he's beating the crap out of him.
But then the giant condor just comes right into his face and is just rah, rah, rah.
He just swipes his hand up gently, and then he has the face shield, and then the condor just keeps pecking on the face shield. See, I have this all planned out. I had a whole backup plan because I knew somebody was going to use King Caesar.